As we sit with him, we could...
As we await the arrival of a quorum, since we do have a rather long agenda today, I think we will just get started with Representative Knuth's bill, seeing that she is present.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Knuth, we do at last have a quorum present, so I will officially call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1852 to be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on Finance with the... I think the appropriate motion would be to go to the General Register, but I'm not sure.
I am not entirely sure about that either, Representative Knuth, because you may want to see it in Ways and Means. I don't think so. But that motion, the motion to return it to Finance will suffice for the time being. And Representative Knuth, I believe you have an amendment. Do you want us to entertain the amendment?
Yep. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form I want it moving forward.
I'm not sure if we have the A1 amendment.
Yeah, I got it.
I'm not finding it in mind, but thank you. Do you want to explain the amendment, or?
The A1 amendment is there's some technical changes on page one, making it the language around the renewable energy production incentive a little more clear, and then. There's an additional area in the language where the hydroelectric facilities are included in the renewable energy payment incentive and renewable development accounts. I just wanted to make that more clear, and so that's what the amendment does. And then we can talk about the bill more generally once it's adopted.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Knuth, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1852 is tweaking some of the renewable energy production incentive language and making it more clear that it's allowed also for hydroelectric facilities under our law to encourage development of these facilities. And there's not a lot of places where we can do that in Minnesota, but to make the finances work for one particular facility that would create jobs as soon as May is my understanding. I'm bringing this bill forward to make sure it works long term. And I have a testifier here from Brookfield Renewable Power who's working on this project. And then if we have any questions about the technical aspects of it, we can have some folks answer those questions as well. But I'm going to turn it over to her to testify about this specific project. Thank you, Mr.
James, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through you to the members for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of House File 1852. My name is Shannon Ames. I'm the Government Relations Manager for Brookfield Renewable Power. Brookfield operates environmentally sustainable hydropower facilities in the United States. We operate on some of the most precious rivers in the United States, including the Mississippi here in St. Paul, as well as in Louisiana, on the Hudson River in New York. in the Adirondack National Park and in the Kennebec River in Maine, the name's from. Last year, we purchased and began operating the Ford Hydroelectric Plant here in St. Paul. And our sister company owns three buildings, actually, in downtown Minneapolis. And now we are embarking on building a new hydropower facility on the lower St. Anthony Falls. So we are excited about being in Minnesota and growing our presence here. As a company, we're committed to clean, renewable power managed in an environmentally sustainable manner. We put health and safety first in terms of our employees and the public and our contractors. We evaluate both our safety rules and our environmental rules every year. We do audits on 22 components in both safety and environmental standards. 45% of our facilities are either certified by or in the process of being certified by the Low Impact Hydropower Institute, which is based in Maine, the independent nonprofit organization. We have a very strong relationship with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission because of our commitment to safety and environmental issues. The project at, we also have a history of and a commitment to working with the communities in which we have facilities. And that has included environmental projects as well as human needs projects. Some of the things we've done are, include building a park to View Falls in New York and making sure that children and families have winter clothing, making major donations to 4-H clubs, etc. The project at Lower St. Anthony Falls is something we're very excited about. The project should begin construction in May. It will employ about 30 people for the 18-month duration of the construction, and we expect to hire at least one full-time permanent person thereafter. The project will have 9.6 megawatts of capacity. It will generate about 63 gigawatt hours of electricity annually, and we have a power purchase agreement with Xcel for that energy. When we did the financial analysis of the project, we included the renewable energy production incentive payment. The REPI payment was critical to making the project viable, and we certainly are appreciative to the state for having such a program. The bill before you today seeks to clarify the language in the REPI statute to ensure that the payment will last in full for the 10 years. We believe that's the intent of the statute, and the language cases simply make that more clear. While the changes contained in the bill do help our specific project, we believe the additional language, specifically including hydropower, is important for the future of hydropower in the state, and we believe we won't be the only project benefiting in the future. Thank you. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say I'm glad to see that we're making use of the hydro generation capacity. I think that's a good thing, and as much of that we can do, the better, I think, for all of us. The question I have, you're working, you said, with Xcel, you have a contract with them. The question I have for, I'm not sure who, whether it's Representative Cooth or whatever, does Xcel get any benefit as far as working towards renewable energy sources? I mean, as they have a goal to reach, does this hydro generation give them credit towards that? I was under the impression that hydro generation was not considered a renewable energy prior to that. So I'm just wondering if this is in fact, it doesn't change anything except I think that it should be counted. If it's not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, and maybe this is a question we could ask Mr. Ailes, but my understanding is hydropower up to a certain capacity is included in the renewable energy standard, and this would be included toward Xcel making progress for the renewable energy standard. But if we could have that confirmed, that would be great.
Mr. Ailes?
Representative Smith is correct. It's hydro up to 100 megawatts in capacity. I'm not sure what, I don't know if you stated the capacity of this project.
9.6.
There we go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Further questions? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, I noticed we're striking the limit of 200 megawatts on wind, and I think there was the Commerce Department would take some of the money in. spread it around among those 200. What's going to be the upper limit on this now, and does that mean that the producer payment gets reduced for as more megawatts come online, or what's going to be the practical outworking of that strike on line 1.12?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, and we might have to have someone from the Department of Commerce come talk about this. I think this is some cleanup language because the upper limit is considered to be the 9.4 million, and we actually have more than 200 megawatts
mm-hmm.
currently receiving the renewable energy production incentive, but we have someone who can speak more knowledgeably about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy if they could. I got a couple questions along that line.
Mr. DeFebvre, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jeremy DeFebvre. I'm with the Office of Energy Security. And Representative Beard, to that specific question, the way 216C41 and laws 2005, Chapter 57, I believe it is, work together, is there are no more wind projects that would be eligible for renewable energy production incentive payments. It is capped as far as the time period that they were eligible to apply, and that period has passed. So as wind projects that are currently receiving it reach their 10-year maximum, those funds become freed up for other purposes. If they are not going to renewable production incentives for either biogas or hydro, they would remain in the RDF.
Senator Beard?
Okay, I thought I heard you say that no new wind projects are coming on, but as the 10-year limit runs out on ones that have been around a while, funds will be freed up. Clarify again, Mr. DeFebvre, freed up for what? For who?
Mr. DeFebvre?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, it would be freed up under these amendments. They could be used to pay either biogas or hydroelectric facilities. This $1.5 million is inadequate for that, or it would simply remain in the Renewable Development Fund for grants and other activities that are eligible under Excel's rules for that.
Representative Beard.
The Renewable Energy Production Incentive comes from the RDF, and we took away the up to, and so now it'll be just $10.9 million a year will go into the producer payments. So I guess there's two questions. Is the RDF, and I know we got new CAS coming, you're anticipating more revenue coming into the RDF from the CAS storage fee thing. I think that's probably a simple question, but then the REPI then, how do we determine how much of a subsidy we're going to give to biogas or to qualifying hydro projects, and would the Crown Roller project fit if it ever gets past the park board?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, the specific subsidy for each facility is set within 216C.41, either a 1.5 cent or a 1 cent, depending on how they qualify. The issue that this in part addresses is that if the amount that is allocated under the $1.5 million that is appropriated towards biogas or hydroelectric were inadequate to pay all of the eligible claims, it would allow use of funds that are not being used for wind when those fall off to pay those. Nothing. If we get to a point where there's still wind and there are more claims of biogas and hydroelectric, then we would likely have to prorate, but I don't see that happening. Wind will be falling off significantly in 2011.
All right, thank you.
Are there any further questions for any of the testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Knuth, read this your motion that House File 1852 as amended be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed to Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Knuth. Representative Kalin, House File 1623. And while Representative Kalin is coming to the table, usually we try to move the minutes at the beginning of the meeting, but usually we have a quorum at the beginning of the meeting. In this case, since we now do, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes from March 18th.
So moved.
Representative Bly, thank you. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes stand approved. Representative Kalin, and before you begin, members, the Game and Fish Division that meets in this room at 4:30 has graciously agreed to move their meeting to a different room, so if we need to run over in order to get through this agenda, we will continue to meet here up until 6 if necessary to get through the agenda. Hopefully we won't need to do that, but just wanted to mention that that is an option. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1623 for possible consideration on omnibus policy bill. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1623 is a fairly straightforward bill as far as bills go related to the Conservation Improvement Program. As you know, utilities can spend up to 5% of their total expenditure requirement on projects that slow down the meter by through generation of renewables rather than through efficiency projects. House File 1623 merely expands the definition of building to essentially any building, residential, commercial, or publicly owned, as well as allows on-site energy storage equipment, essentially what we would think of as batteries, but as new storage technologies come on board, I think that we need to have a slightly broader definition and opportunity for businesses. And a great example of one of those businesses is with me today, Mr. Dan Feast, and he can explain how the change will help grow jobs here in Minnesota.
Steve, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Feast. I'm CEO of a company called Energy Harvest Group here in St. Paul. We've been around for a few years now, and we do large-scale photovoltaic and solar thermal installations and design. What we have done is we are now partnering with going into a joint venture with a company out of California called iCell Systems, and we are bringing lithium ion storage manufacturing to St. Paul to couple that with renewables. And I look at the language being changed to include storage as helping us to accomplish our mission of doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Steese. Are there any questions for Representative Westrom?
Not. I have one for the author once we're done with testimony.
I think we are done with testimony, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, let me just broach a topic with you, and I need to look through your bill a little closer. But you're just amending to allow storage to be part of SIP. Do you have any efforts going forward that maybe a little more aggressively allows utilities to count solar projects or things like that towards their SIP, if they would put some SIP expenditures towards that, in that it's still renewable, it still displaces the need for electrons on their system? Any reaction to that? And the reason I ask is I've got language in a bill form I'm putting together, but also an amendment just that would address that type of an issue, and curious what your reaction would be. That type of an expansion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom, on the savings side, with the change we made in 2007 from a spending requirement to an energy savings requirement, the key provision, the key test, excuse me, on the energy savings is cost effectiveness. I would still maintain that those projects outside the 5% of spending requirement on the results end need to be cost effective, and I don't think that solar PV has made that test on the electrical side. I do think that solar thermal meets that test on the gas side for heating. As to the 5% spending requirements, I think Mr. Feast presents a good opportunity where we can recognize that one of the challenges with solar generation is the storage. It's generating at a different time as the point in the actual electricity needed. And that's what I think the change really does. I think that, Representative Westrom, there may be other means of getting to the goal that I think you and I share, which is to make remove barriers to broader development of solar, especially solar PV in Minnesota. And so I look forward to seeing your bill language and continuing the conversation.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Kalin, we will lay House File 1623 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you very much.
Bill is laid over. Representative Johnson, House File 1992. Sure. Representative Johnson, I'm going to move your bill for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1992 says a couple of things. First of all, establish a Solar Cities working group looking at accelerating the rates of solar and thermal electrical energy installations. Also requires reports to the Legislative Energy Commission in 2009 and 2010, October 1st in each state. And lastly, it seeks $7 million from state energy funds received from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And just as a way of context, Mr. Chair and members, the City of St. Paul and Minneapolis are part of a Solar Cities initiative. Recently, they were awarded $200,000 grant and $250,000 technical assistance from the U.S. Department of Energy as part of Solar America Cities initiative. And these Solar Cities have been working with several groups and considering this matter, including the Center for Energy and Environment, Fresh Energy, XL Energy, and numerous solar installers. And to speak to this bill, we have a couple of testifiers, and I'll turn over them to say a few words about what this entails.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hilty and Representative Johnson. I'm Ann Hunt, the Environmental Policy Advisor for Mayor Chris Coleman in St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. As Representative Johnson mentioned, the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, along with the Minnesota Department of Energy Security, under the leadership of Jen Steph's team, particularly Stacey Miller, secured a wonderful opportunity from the Department of Energy this year to really look at how to jumpstart solar in the state of Minnesota. As you know, the state and the utilities, particularly XL, have invested millions into developing wind energy in our state. But this is something that we can that we're all proud of, but we haven't really invested as much technical research and other things into looking at what are the opportunities for solar in Minnesota. I had a map that we could distribute to members, which I unfortunately didn't get in your packet, but just shows the solar resources, and I think you had a similar map last, I think at their last hearing. And at some point, I think it would be really great if we could bring the Department of Energy and the National Renewable Energy Lab, who are willing to come to Minnesota and kind of talk about this initiative and what's going on nationally. We were one of 25 cities that were selected across the country to get this particular grant, and they can kind of talk about where their sea solar going in the country, what are some of the best practices that have been identified from various states, what kind of financial resources are other states putting into, and what are the kind of green jobs opportunities for cities that are part of the Solar Cities program nationally. We think solar combined with energy efficiency appears to be a perfect fit for urban cities that we're not, where we're not able to erect large wind turbines. We're hoping to secure $7 million from the federal stimulus money to initiate several large projects along the central corridor between downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis and in other parts of XL's service territory. It's been Mayor Chris Coleman's vision to make the area around the light rails a national model for green manufacturing and renewable energy. It was with the help of Chairman Hilty and this committee that we were able to secure 2 years ago some funding to research renewable energy options for Rack 10, the state's largest paper recycler and the city's largest green manufacturer. And from that, we learned at Rack 10, this has also helped the Port Authority develop the concept for the Trillion BTU initiative for other large commercial industrial customers. So these are some of the things that you'll hear later today about what's going on in Central Corridor. It's our hope with the Solar Cities Initiative to add at least 1 megawatt of solar along the Central Corridor. This spring and early summer, we'll be identifying with the help of DOE and the National Renewable Energy Lab potential sites. We're looking for large municipal parking ramps or other large public buildings as sites to put the solar on, so we'll be having that solar site mapping done. And XL has already been exploring other options for large businesses or institutions along the corridor, and you'll hear more about that in a little bit. With the federal stimulus money, we hope to really jumpstart this initiative. We've been working with Fresh Energy, as you heard Representative Johnson say, and Center for Energy and the Environment, XL, the Renewable Energy Society, and a number of private installers who are here today to support the bill. At this point, I'd like to just quickly turn it over to Linda Taylor from Fresh Energy to also talk about some of the highlights in this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Mott. Ms. Taylor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Linda Taylor. I'm the Clean Energy Director at Fresh Energy in St. Paul. Ann mentioned, we met several times, many times, over the past several months to talk about how do we begin to get solar going in Minnesota without simply putting some money and putting some projects on buildings and then running out of money. The idea of the group was to try to figure out how do we move forward in a deliberate way, take advantage of the technologies that are improving quickly over time, but not waste money. The idea is to try to gradually ramp up over time so that we can take advantage of the fact that the costs for solar energy are coming down very quickly, and they're coming down more quickly than we thought they were going to. So we've got some real opportunities coming in the very near future. The idea of this group, and it was really quite a broad group, and we didn't really have agreement on everything, but we did have agreement on a number of things. And one was to have a working group, to continue a working group forward that could be fairly responsive and make recommendations about, you know, what the next step is. And that's the idea of having two reports back to the Legislative Energy Commission in such quick succession. One would be this coming October, the next one would be the October after that. And the way that the appropriation would work is it would be $7 million from the stimulus bill, and half of that would be dedicated to the solar cities, particularly the light rail corridor, to do demonstration projects. This is where we're the most ready to go. It's where we can see the progress that we make, so it will be very visible. The other half of the money, however, would be dedicated to statewide projects to begin to bring that outside of the cities to showing what we can do and replicate projects good well as we go. So it'll be about $3.5 million for the Solar Cities project, probably mostly along the Central Corridor, light rail corridor, $3.5 million for statewide projects. The goals of this group, as you'll see kind of listed on the second page of the bill, you know, these are sort of lofty in some ways, but in other ways this is the idea, to try to identify the things that will do the best job, that will get us there the most quickly, that will be the most solid, that will move us forward deliberately. I think that one of the things that we recognize as a group is that, you know, we jump-started wind energy in Minnesota by simply demanding 400 megawatts of wind power, and a second 400 megawatts if those proved cost-effective. And it did, and that's good. A lot of people worked hard to make that happen. We don't feel that that's really the right approach for solar. And so we think that by moving into it more gently and more deliberately, hopefully we can build on it and build on the successes as we go forward. Thank you.
Are there questions for Representative Johnson or testifiers? Representative Magna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the commission in here, the commission means the Legislative Energy Commission. Doesn't mean the POC, correct? It means the...
You're referring where?
Well, there's several lines in here, Mr. Chairman, line 1.14.
Energy Commission is specifically mentioned.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman, if the... Oh, okay, I've got the wrong bill. That explains.
Okay. House file 1992.
All right.
I think the only commission reference in that is to the Legislative Energy Commission. Unless I overlooked something. Perhaps I should ask while Representative Magnus is perusing the bill if anyone else has any questions or comments. Representative Magnus, it is the Chairs and count to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. So. We will have the opportunity to raise questions later. Well, seeing no further discussion at this time, Representative Johnson, thank you. The bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Johnson, if you want to stay where you are, we'll take up House File 1434 next on the agenda. Representative Johnson moves House File 1434 for consideration of the omnibus bill. Representative Johnson, I believe you have an amendment to that bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
That is just being distributed, but I believe it's basically a technical amendment. Do you want to explain the amendment, Representative Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What this amendment does is specifies that the initiative that we're going to be talking about here includes residential and commercial conservation programs and solar developments along the corridor, Central Corridor in particular, and that Xcel is applying for federal funds to help fund this particular project.
So, Representative Johnson moves the H 1434 A1 amendment to get the bill in the form in which he wishes to have it considered. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's okay with the chair, there's five bills that more or less go together here, and I have a couple presenters that are going to give us an overview of the Central Corridor Energy Project, and I think the next bills will flow more easily if we look at it in a total package. And after they do their presentation, then I'll present specifically the bill that we have before us.
That'll be fine.
Thank you, Representative Chilty. My name is Judy Pofro. I'm Regional Vice President for Shell Energy here in Minneapolis. I'm glad to, glad to be here today. In your packets, I believe there is a PowerPoint presentation, and that's what I will be stepping through here today. It's this color kind of PowerPoint. The title is the Central Corridor Partnership. And I'll just walk through that briefly. I think it will give you some context for the overall proposal. You know, this project really started, if you look at slide two, from that transportation plan that's out there. That is where major corridors of transit or other kinds of transportation is planned within the urban area here. And as we looked at that, and as you know, we're also doing a CapEx transmission project, which is bringing transmission in towards the urban areas. Once we get to the urban areas, there's not really a plan. And most of our infrastructure actually runs around along these major transportation routes. And our thought had been it would be a good idea for us to get out ahead of these projects, actually work with the transportation plan, so that our energy facilities can be planned at the same time and in conjunction with each other. It's certainly no one likes it really very well when the streets are ripped up for construction, but the typical model right now would be that as the road construction or the transit construction is going on, we would be asked to move our facilities and relocate them and then put them back. As we do upgrades to our facilities, we would ask for permission to work in the streets. And those two things really did not go together as well as they could have. So our thought was, can we do a better job if we actually do transportation planning and energy planning more cohesively and together? In answering to that question, then it also brings to bear, as these transit facilities go into place, what kind of development is going to happen along the route that we as energy providers should be planning for? And then also just what can we bring as a planning partner to the table to make this project a more valuable one for the community? Certainly we've got expertise in energy efficiency, renewables. This is a good place for us to apply that expertise. And in doing so, actually bring benefits to the community and hopefully better acceptance of these types of projects as they go forward. So if you turn to the third slide, our proposal is really to try to get to a good planning model where energy and transportation is better planned together, where we make both of them smart and green. And I don't mean those just as buzzwords, but really what can we do to make this a next generation type of system? And then also to create an energy showcase in the urban area. You know, we have a lot of renewables providing energy on our system, but most of it's located in southwestern Minnesota. They aren't very visible to our customers. How do we bring renewable energy to a place where people see it at work? And certainly solar along this corridor would be a very visible way of doing it. The other thing that's an issue for us really is that there's really no ribbon cuttings or ceremonies as people do DSM or conservation programs. What can we do to make that more visible, the benefits of it? And if you're doing things in a real concentrated area, trying to create a showcase, we think we can do that. And in doing so, we'll create synergies and benefits and hopefully get this more integrated across our whole system. So the idea is, can we create a showcase? If you turn to the next slide, which I think is slide four, you'll see how that looks kind of like a tinker toy model there. But on the circles outside, you'll see all the different piece part components to our thoughts about what we can do in the Central Corridor. And certainly a number of these things we already do. Energy efficiency, load management, we already do renewables. But the thought is, can we bring them together in a real concentrated way to create that showcase? There's other piece parts here that we have the idea of but maybe don't have the ability to deliver right now. For example, distributed solar. Can we support that through rebates and things? Those are some tools that we're asking for the permission for, the support for in some of the bills that you'll be hearing about today. And then other things are really on the cusp of some of the smart technologies and rolling those out on our distribution system with substations and transformers, making them more efficient and also smarter, where they're telling us, you know, when maintenance is needed, when we need to get out there, improving reliability. Those types of things we're on the cusp of. Can we demonstrate them here in this corridor and bring about those benefits? So that's really the notion. We've got a lot of parts here already, but can we bring them in a concentrated dose here in the Central Corridor, along with the transit project, and help bring benefits to that community, along with creating awareness across our system? So the next slide, I won't talk about in much detail, but it just goes into a little bit about the piece parts on energy efficiency. Can we obtain 50%? This is the goals we're talking about. 50% greater penetration of our conservation improvement programs in this area. If we can, that would provide significant benefits. On that next slide on renewable energy, could we do a concentrated marketing effort to get people to put solar up on their roofs? Along this corridor, there is a lot of flat roof space where solar could be demonstrated. Could we do a marketing effort and have a program in place to help support that, bring it about in a very visible way on our system? And then could we do a demonstration project of larger scale solar and how it could best be put on our system with maybe a battery to back it up and some load management on the customer side so that we could really look at how can we bring all these technologies together in the best, most cost-effective way and in a way that may help us defray other investments on our systems down the road. So we're really trying to look ahead, get our system in place to be ready for tomorrow and our customers' needs. And then last on slide 7, I just mentioned some of the innovative technology types of things that we could do. And the one I'll note for you is being ready for the plug-in hybrids. And as you know, the stimulus package is providing a lot of funding and encouragement for those types of things. But certainly, it's now when we're planning transit and we'd be in the streets putting in our distribution facilities that we should plan for where do we want plug-in hybrid stations to be. Where should our cars be or other things along that route? And let's put in, while the streets are ripped up now, that infrastructure so that we're ready when it comes. So those are some of the things that we're thinking about. That next slide, slide 8, just shows you an illustrative map of the corridor. And some of the things on there are the questions or the thoughts that we have in mind. But you'll see it would run from Union Depot in St. Paul to the Minneapolis Multimodal Station and through the university on the way. And we just noticed some of the energy projects that are going on in this area are some of the things that we could do. For example, the Rock 10 biogas project would be there, but certainly we can put solar up on rooftops. You see some ideas about how we could highlight on panels or display boards how much energy is being saved there today, how much carbon's been avoided in this corridor. We could do other things to promote our conservation programs, talking about what's going on in the businesses right along here. So this is the notion of what we're talking about. And as we talk about the corridor zone, we're talking about going along this route and maybe cutting a quarter mile around it so that all those businesses and residents in that area can benefit from these offerings. So the last slide there, slide 9, or near last slide there, slide 9, is talking about what kind of legislative supports are in the bills that will be before you today that help make this happen. And they're coming up to you in pieces. But one is to provide that mass transit zone designation and mechanism that would allow us a place where all the support that we're bringing to this effort that really isn't captured in one of our other programs can be approved by, proposed to the Public Utilities Commission, approved by them if it meets certain standards that would be laid out in statute, and then we'd have a mechanism for recovering our costs. To allow for expanded solar investments, and that's to help us support giving rebates to customers for solar projects that they may do, creating a solar in our green pricing program so that when people want to pay us for additional renewable energy, solar can be a piece of that, and then also the rebate type efforts that might go through the conservation improvement program, And then the encouraging of an expanded incentive for SIF, because certainly conservation is going to be a major piece of this, and it's another piece of legislation that will at least be talked about here today. And so that last slide on slide 10 briefly shows you just kind of the grid of, here are some of the components that we're thinking of within the Central Corridor, the House incentive files that correspond to that. And that's the overview we have of the project. We're very excited about it. We're very excited about the partnerships we've formed with people in the community and with the customers along the route, with the transit authorities, because certainly it's by working with them together that we can leverage each other's resources and expertise and actually make this project a reality. So that's our overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you may have.
Are there questions from members at this time? Representative Johnson, do we have other people on the list? Mr. Palmer or Ms. Hunt, Mr. Jacobson, do we want
to? You may want to be here just to answer questions, or did you?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay, I could speak directly to the bill at this time, if you wish, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Please proceed, Representative Johnson.
Back to House File 1434, and what House File 1434 does as part of this enabling legislation is creates a, what we call transit zone for utility reinvestment and cost recovery. And if you look at the amendment, it states that it would extend no more than 1/2 mile and other cited the route for the planned light rail transit system along Minneapolis-St. Paul University Avenue. And here's why the bill is needed. The bill authorizes the PUC to allow a utility to recover its costs when it relocates its facilities for a transit zone. And these costs are otherwise not collected from ratepayers until utility files its next rate case. And the bill also authorizes the PUC to allow a utility to recover the investments it makes to install advanced technologies when it's relocating utilities. The PUC doesn't have clear statutory direction to allow utilities to recover costs for infrastructure investments for forward-looking or emerging technologies, and the bill addresses those issues. I will note that the PUC has expressed some concern that the language is too broad, and Excel tells me that they're working with the PUC on language that will narrow the bill to a pilot project, and that seems to provide more clarity for this legislation. And I will leave it at that for questions for myself or testifiers.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, is there a fiscal note for this bill?
Pardon?
Is there a fiscal note?
I don't have a fiscal note.
Is there one being prepared?
Not to my knowledge.
Mr. Chair, is this going to be laid over into the omnibus bill then?
It is, Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, do you have any idea of what these new costs, we're looking at new facilities, replacement facilities, relocated facilities to be installed? Do you have any idea? Or does Excel have any idea what the approximate cost is going to be overall?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vance, approximately $38 million is the number I've been given for the entire project.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Johnson, Representative Johnson, is that ongoing cost or is that just the startup cost?
Ms. Cofferell, do you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Chair Hilke. Yes, I'd like to respond to that. The investments that would be made here would be paid for by Xcel Energy and recovered from our ratepayers. So it's not money that would be coming from the state. The total project cost that we would see going through this mass transit zone mechanism that's being proposed here would be around $38 million in total. That would be recovered from our customers over the life of the project. So we're talking about maybe an $8 million rate difference for our customers over time. And given our, you know, we've got a customer base of over 1 million customers, you can get a sense of that size. That number, though, is including our major solar and our distribution system investments, things like that. It doesn't include the cost that we would be doing for perhaps solar rebates or our conservation improvement programs, which are done under other programs and recovered in different ways. So the $38 million is the piece that would be going through the mechanism provided by this bill.
Well, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I take it that once this project gets underway, or it's already in the process of getting underway, there's going to be have to be some land purchased along the way, and are we going to have to be using eminent domain to purchase this these pieces of parcels to make this project work?
Representative Johnson? Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I haven't heard that raised as an issue, and I'll defer to my...
Representative, I don't believe so. We already have facilities in the area. Certainly the transit... Oh, do you want to take this? This is Greg Palmer, who's a director within Excellency.
Mr. Palmer. Chairman Hilty, Representative Anderson.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Gregory Palmer. I'm the Director of Account Management for Xcel Energy. I have responsibility for the Central Corridor effort that we're talking about here within Xcel. The intent is not to take any public lands, that we would work with property owners. There might be some government agencies we work with on existing government facilities, but there would not be any condemnation of new land or anything like that to support this effort.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for either testifier, depending on who prefers to answer it, but I'm wondering about what the difference would be between distributed solar along a transit corridor and distributed solar in other areas of the city.
Representative, I'm glad you asked that question, because exactly what we're talking about here is a concentrated application of programs that we would propose to offer across all of our system. And so the notion of giving rebates for solar, for people to install solar, I think one of the bills that you'll consider later is actually trying to enable that process. We would offer that system-wide. What we're talking about here, then, is trying to really market those programs and use our community partners to really do outreach to get a concentrated dose in a very visible way along the corridor. So it's not to say we wouldn't do it in other parts of our system.
Any further discussion? Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to Ms. Corporal. You made the comments about reinvesting in the community, and I applaud you for that effort. I think we're doing some of the things that we need to do to make the investments now that we pay dividends long term. One question I have, maybe you can help me out with this, is I'm a large proponent of community-owned energy, and we've looking for ways to try to reinvest in some of our cities and other areas of parts of the state, which you referenced, but I've gotten some pushback that, like your company or among other utilities, have said that they don't feel that maybe paying a little higher price in the first 10 years, even if it is lower in the later years of the project, is of maybe the best investment, or it's maybe not needed to fit the needs. But I look at this as one of your service territories. You're saying that it's wise to make these investments, and I'm hoping that we can find some common ground for my rural parts of the state that we can agree to make these investments to communities as well by focusing on having local people own the resources.
Representative, certainly we'd be happy to talk with you about that further. I know we've had conversations over the years. You know, one of the ideas that we have with respect to our green pricing program, I'll just throw this out as an example. This is where customers can agree to pay extra to us to know that more of their energy came from renewable sources. And we go out and develop renewables over and above what we otherwise would have done to fuel that program. One of our ideas is that we actually ask our customers to help provide the resource to fuel that program, and that we would put out for bid the idea of your large customer sites that could accommodate a large-scale solar. They could then work with developers to bring proposals to us. We'll select the best ones and put that into that program. So we're trying to find ways that we can do this together and certainly create some opportunities for our customers in the process.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Johnson, thank you. House File 1434 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Saylor, House File 1478. Representative Saylor. I believe your motion would be to have House File 1478 before us for consideration for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Saylor, I believe you have an amendment
that
you
correct.
Wanted to offer.
I would like to move the A1 amendment. Just makes a couple of minor adjustments to the bill.
It's just being distributed, members. It's just a two-line amendment. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait to act on it until it has been distributed. Representative Saylor, perhaps you'd... I don't think it's going to significantly alter the meaning or intent of the bill. If you want to just go ahead and present the bill, we'll act on the amendment when it's been distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it does not make a significant difference. As we're looking to broaden our energy production base for both security and stability, we need to look at all sectors of energy production. And one of the things that this bill does is allows XL Energy to work with the Office of Environmental Security or Energy Security to raise the level of SIP spending allowed for solar development. And last year, Xcel agreed to place a small amount of solar spending into its SIP budget, subject to a 5% cap for renewable energy spending. And they did agree to come back with ideas to advance solar development for Minnesota, throughout Minnesota. And this bill will allow customers to install small solar projects on their home or business and to use that power to offset energy use similar to traditional conservation projects. They will also receive a substantial rebate toward the upfront cost. Their market analysis indicates that there's a stronger demand for this customer participation than we've looked at in the past. So they are seeking permission to work with the OES to meet that customer demand. And I guess if there are any other questions, I do have Judy Popperl here to answer any other questions. He did allude to some of the things in this bill earlier when they were doing the overview, but I would just say if there are any questions at this time.
Well, first of all, Representative Saylor, the amendment has been distributed. Do you want to briefly explain what the amendment does, and we can act on that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment makes a couple of small changes on line 1.2 after the A. Just insert municipality, rural electric association, or public for utility. It just further clarifies the description of the utilities. And then on page 1, line 23, after the A, insert but not to exceed 10%. And that brings us in line with this bill as it's moving through the Senate. Those are the only changes.
Questions to the amendment? Representative Anderson?
No.
Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, well, I don't think we've moved the amendment. You need to move the amendment, Representative Taylor.
I will move the A1 amendment.
All those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Saylor, do you know how much this will affect the by allowing this for
customers to go ahead with this that will affect the XL rate payers as far as the cost?
Ms. Popperell or Representative
Sure, I think Ms. Popperell will answer that.
Ms. Popperell.
Representative Hilke, Representative, we're thinking at least as we're planning this program that we'd like to offer, which is a rebate program much like our other rebate programs for energy efficiency appliances, that we'd like to offer rebates to our customers, the total budget of which would be around $5 million is what we're targeting to. Certainly, we're trying to leverage other resources that would be available to support distributed solar, including things that might be competitive solicitations for the stimulus package. But overall, what we're thinking of trying to target this budget to is about $5 million. We've just seen in offering this program in other places that the customer demand is actually higher than we would have thought, and we just want to make sure that as we offer the program, we have enough resource behind it. What this would allow us to do is to go to the Department of or the Office of Energy Security, show our projections for demand or how the demand is coming in for the program once we have approval, and just have flexibility to make sure we can put the funding behind it as the program rolls out.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the testifier, you said that you found a greater interest among customers. What would you say the percentage of the increase that you've seen coming back to you as far as this program here among rate payers or people that would like to put this in place? What amount?
Representative Hilke, Representative, we actually have not offered the program yet. We would like to propose the program to the Office of Energy Security for inclusion in our CIP program, our Conservation Improvement Program. But as we gauge interest, I think some of the... The $5 million budget would support 600 customers going through this program or create about 2 megawatts of solar on our system a year. And so that's roughly where we're targeting it to. Of course, until you've marketed it, you don't know. And certainly with the economy as it is, how much resource is there to support getting it done? You know, these things kind of go up and down as you're rolling out a program, but that's what we would target to. Certainly we have found interest in our customer base for the program. If we don't spend it, if that demand is not there, we do not collect anything. I mean, we would only collect what we actually spend.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
To the testifier, you've not done an actual survey to actually determine this.
No. Representative Hilke, we have not.
Thank you.
Representative Galen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question, but I think I'll wait to talk about it offline with Ms. Bodero. But I just will point out for the committee's information that the solar rebate program that was funded out of, I believe, the general fund through by this committee the last couple of years was exhausted because of individual interest within 3 or 4 months of this offering, even then after adding supplemental funding, exhausted again very, very quickly. So there's clearly need out there, and I think the chair could probably speak to that from his own experience as well.
Are there further questions at this time? Seeing none, House File 1478 will be laid over, and Representative Saylor, you have, if I can find my paperwork, another bill. House File 1425. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move House File 1425 for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Well, thank you, Representative Saylor. You want to proceed to explain the bill?
Again, this bill dovetails in with some of the others working at broadening our use and availability of solar. And House File 1425
allows the XL Energy to count the solar energy that they would build in conjunction with a research project involving energy storage and smart grid load management towards their wind portion of the RES. And
Representative Saylor, I think we have a number of confusion here.
And the other bill.
Between House File 1533 and House File 1425. But since you started on 1533, maybe we should just continue.
No, you're right. Actually, Mr. Chair, I have 1425 in front of me here. Did you want me to take up 1533?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, it is confusing with so many bills that are so similar. I know I have three of them that I've been kind of sorting and resorting here. But if I may continue with the 1425, just to say that Excel's RES mandate involves 30% renewable energy by 2020, of which 25% must be wind. The other 5% is fully subscribed with long-term biomass and small hydro commitments. So the only place left for them to count this renewable energy is within the wind component of the RES. This will be a small amount of solar, but an important project so they can learn how these technologies work together, again, to broaden that base.
And Representative Saylor or Ms. Poferel, if I understand correctly from your previous testimony, what would be contemplated here is like 1 to 2 megawatts of capacity?
Representative Kelsey, that's correct. That's at least what the project is that we'd be looking at within the central corridor. That's relatively sized. And in contrast, when you look at how much wind we are adding on our system, we're adding, you know, several thousand megawatts. So in proportion, it really is not a significant amount. It's just that otherwise we have no place to count it towards our renewable energy standards.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has Excel made an estimate of what the cost per kilowatt will be for solar versus wind and versus what we're using now, and how much more expensive it will be, or how much in relationship to the cost of present energy sources?
Representative Anderson, certainly the solar is more expensive. We're talking or estimating that it would be around $11 million for the 1 megawatt project, and that's certainly not what the cost of wind is. So the value of this project, at least as we see it, is that it will look at ways that we can deploy renewables in an urban setting, which is something we think is valuable. It will look at ways that we can use the customer side of managing their load and a battery, which could help store the solar when perhaps we don't use it, need it, to help defray other investments on our system, mostly those wires that go down the street. Because certainly the better we can manage things on the customer side, the fewer investments we need to make. So this is really a good demonstration project. That's what it's intended to be. It will, though, supply renewable energy, and we would like to be able to count it towards our renewable energy standards.
Representative Anderson.
Will this count against your limit as far as will this deter the amount that you could use for solar, or are you wide open to the amount of solar that you want to use?
Ms. Pulfer.
Representative Anderson, it's not there's no cap. I'll just explain what our current plan would be. And certainly as other technologies change and as the cost of solar comes down, things will change over this period up till 2020, and we certainly may see more applications for solar. But for right now, that's really all we have in our plan.
Thank you.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to qualify, this is needed to try to push forward a demonstration project. That's the intention of opening up this basically requirement to buy wind, to expand it to solar, is because you want to push forward a demonstration project as a mechanism. Is that the intention?
That's all for all.
Representative Hilty, I'm not sure that I would say that it was the intention. Certainly as we were looking at this corridor project, what we can do on our system, what we can do in the urban area to bring renewables, solar is the technology that seems to work there, and we've had a lot of interest in it. We would like the ability to bring that to this project, but again, to get the benefit of it towards our RES, it just simply wouldn't count under existing law. So we were seeking that flexibility to count it. Was it the sole purpose? I don't know. Certainly it gives us more flexibility in how we comply with the RES, and we do think that's usually a good thing. But it's certainly not something that we're expecting is going to significantly erode our plans to invest in wind. We need a lot of wind on our system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would the total investment likely be that would go into your rate case to pay for this?
Representative Hilty, the estimated cost for a 1 megawatt solar project that would be about $11 million. The other ancillary pieces of it, like the battery and some of the other load control, would total about another 7 for a total of about 18. Now, in contrast, you know, the level of investment to get, you know, several thousand megawatts of wind is certainly much more substantial than that. This is a relatively small investment in the RES, but we think an important one that should at least be allowed to count.
If I can follow up with just one, because I get back to my previous point about this is an investment in the community, which I agree with, but it frustrates me when I am told that the areas in my part of the state, the rural parts, where we have the wind resource, there is not as much of a drive to go and allow our communities to own and invest in the resources. And I've got significant pushback because we're trying to maybe pay a little bit more in the first 10 years to lock in a lower price in the second 10 years, but that's been told that there's no appetite for that in the rate cases or in the power agreements being pushed by your company. So I'm seeing I'm frustrated by the fact that I want to, and I completely agree that these investments are good to make, mm-hmm. but I also would like that when you're getting the resources from some of our parts of the state, that you would help us to make the investments in our communities as well, and to keep those dollars local, and to allow our people to benefit from that resource, which they deal with on a daily basis.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to go one part back of the project. One of the issues we're trying to address in the project is we see the cost of solar coming down. It's becoming more and more competitive with our grid. We don't know if it's 10 years or 15. There's a lot of flexibility when you see those lines crossing. But this project is a research project that says if we have high-density solar in our system, how do we operate that system so that we can operate the grid with the stability that high-tech manufacturers need, and what are the implications? And what we hope to do is develop a model that would, in essence, train our engineering staff, have the research behind us, so that we can provide a stable grid as more and more solar is added over the next 15 years.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. And to the testifiers, you brought up the estimate of $18 million to get to 1 megawatt of solar on the grid or within the customer base. And I'm just thinking about, you can buy, about a 1.5 megawatt of wind for a couple million dollars. Mm-hmm. So the cost difference is quite substantial. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about putting together a pilot project for solar, and there's been so much discussion on solar, not in Minnesota, but in other states. I'm just wondering, is there a pilot project that's already been implemented in some other part of the country or some other community around the globe where we can look to and see what they've done and not have to make that sizable of an investment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilty, we are doing large solar projects in other parts of our service territory. What we are designing here is maybe a different approach. What we're trying to do is a research project that would really advance the understanding of solar. So we have, and there's a range, but it's 1 to 2 megawatts of solar that we would be putting on
along with batteries and load control in the system, and we would operate it under different configurations. I did not bring graphs, but if you look at solar, the production on solar is very variable. If clouds go over, you lose production. And the question is, as you get high-density solar on your distribution system, can you operate a stable system? So we're looking at this as an investment to prepare us as that density increases, and that's what's driving up the cost. We can put in solar at a lot lower cost than $11 million a megawatt, but we can't get the research benefits we're talking about here.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. One other person that did want to testify on this very briefly. I recognize that you are trying to move things along.
Mr. Chair and the committee, Mr. Chair, thank you for an opportunity to testify here just briefly. My name is Ralph Jacobson. I am the owner and operator of Innovative Power Systems. I've been doing solar installations in the Twin Cities for the last almost two decades. For instance, the Science Museum, the Green Institute, and a number of other cutting-edge projects, which I guess that puts me on the bleeding edge. I guess I'm here to testify because I am, although I wouldn't have foreseen it even a year ago, I'm thrilled to be able to come down here and testify on behalf of some things that Xcel Energy is doing, because it really puts the market in a step function higher in terms of the interactions between businesses that need to develop working relationships, the synergies that will develop along the avenue. I would like to talk specifically about the issue of the price of photovoltaics as well, although I think Mr. Palmer did a good job of telling you why it's pretty pricey. But the fact of the matter is the sun shines during the daytime when power is more expensive. And think of it in terms of a monolithic market that we throw all our costs in the hopper and then blend it up and then create an average price. Now, that doesn't work for hot summer afternoons when the utility has to go out in the spot market. And so, really, rather than looking at 5 cents a kilowatt hour wind power, you might look at $500 a kilowatt hour spot market power and say, well, okay, maybe there's the thing that we should be comparing photovoltaic power to. Now it looks pretty cheap, and in fact that's where photovoltaic power does compete. The fact that you don't have to put any infrastructure into the neighborhood around the light rail line, because this technology is deployed right at the point of use or on the roof nearby the point of use, means that there is a cost savings there, which is very substantial for the utility. You roll all those costs together, and I would say that we have a cost-effective technology here. It really depends on what we compare to. Thank you. That's all I wanted to point out.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Jacobson? Seeing none, thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Saylor, anything further on 1425?
No, Mr. Chair. I would just renew my motion for consideration as amended or into the omnibus bill.
Representative Saylor, House File 1425 will be laid over. And Representative Saylor, House File 1533.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move House File 1533 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Very well. Representative Saylor, you want to explain your bill?
Yes. And, Mr. Chair, I also have an A1 amendment. I don't know if you would like that to go at this time or later.
Do we have the A1 amendment distributed? It's just being distributed, Representative Saylor. So why don't you explain your bill, and then we'll act on the amendment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill does, House File 1533, does two things. First, it clarifies that energy storage devices that are used to support renewable energy projects are eligible for cost recovery. Xcel Energy has a 1 megawatt battery that's connected to an 11 megawatt wind farm in Luverne. They're learning how batteries can be used in conjunction with wind energy to support the power grid when the wind is not blowing. And secondly, it extends the law that outlines how green pricing tariff works. Xcel intends to add a solar component to its current green pricing program to allow customers who wish to be involved in solar technology development to voluntarily participate through their monthly energy bills. This is, of course, similar to the wind source that many people around the state are already doing with their local power bills. It just will allow them to add that same opportunity to add solar power if they so choose.
Ms. Fofferl, did you want to add anything to that at this time?
Representative Hilty, no, not really. We certainly support these bills. I think they give them some additional clarity to existing law, and then also just once the green pricing program mandate went away, we thought it was useful to keep it on the books as a voluntary program and keep those standards and parameters still in place so that as companies that want to still offer those services, there's some guidelines for the commission for its approval. So we would support both of these bills.
The amendment, Representative Saylor, has been distributed. Do you want to explain the amendment and move the amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the H1533A1 amendment. And what that amendment does is, again, there's some further clarification to make clear that the energy storage devices that are used in a research mode qualify for cost recovery. And this allows the utilities to get pre-approval from the PUC for energy storage devices prior to going through the formal cost recovery process. That's what the first part of the amendment is about, that 1.2, 1.3. It's just that clarification. And then the second part of the amendment for the green pricing tariff just changes that statute from a mandatory to a voluntary program and removes the requirement that a plan be filed for voluntary green pricing programs.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To the bill. Any discussion? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question which may be better for Mr. Elis than Ms. Fofferl, but either one that can take a crack at it. I noticed that we're in Section 1 of 1533. We're now proposing cost recovery for research and development. Have we done this in the past? Is this new territory for us?
Mr. Elis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it mostly is new territory, although I think I see Dr. Haar sitting behind you, Representative Kalin, and you could probably tell us to what extent that's the case at the commission. But I would ask the committee to hear from Dr. Haar on that point.
Representative Tilke, I can take a crack at that too when it's time.
Go right ahead, Ms. Fofferl.
Oh, okay. Well, this will show that I'm a dinosaur around utility regulation fields. But way back when I was an analyst for the Department of Public Service, there was a statutory program that actually had the acronym of ERP. I can't recall what it meant, but it was utility renewable energy research, whatever, where there was an actual special carve-out in statute for utilities to do demonstration projects and kind of research projects in renewable, and this was long before we had wind. So there were a couple of things like that that were predecessors to SIP, and certainly in the Conservation Improvement Program, there are pieces that support R&D. And so I think here in this bill,
you know, we've got the recovery for energy storage already, but what we were trying to at least make clear so that when the commission looks at our proposal, they have some guidance, is that things like that demonstration project that we're talking about, the components of that would be at least eligible for them to consider for approval.
Thank you, Ms. Belfrill. Dr. Herr.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I would agree with what Ms. Belfrill said about IRF and the SIP program. There certainly are provisions for R&D there.
Dr. Herr, you do need to identify yourself for the record.
I always do that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. My name is
Burl. I was counting on that.
My name is Burl Herr. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. So I was about to say, in the commission's rate-setting process there, the issue of research expenses and so on does come up in the context of rate proceedings. And the commission actually has some policy guidelines that it follows, and typically it allows recovery in a rate-making context for... I'm trying to just summarize what the guidelines say. Basically, any research that's very focused clearly identifies benefits and benefits that accrue to ratepayers. So that there's a direct link between whatever research is being incorporated into rates and the people who are paying the bills. So there is some provision for that. It's fairly limited. It's usually a very small part of the overall revenue requirement, but it does also take place in the context of rate making. The most typical example of this, not nearly as specific as the language in the bill, is for expenditures for the Electric Power Research Institute, EPRI, which is one of the major national electric industry research facilities. So that's some background on how it occurs in rate making.
Any questions for Dr. Herr or... Thank you, Dr. Representative Galen. To the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, I think I would be correct in stating that under a rate case or under a SIP filing, there's a great deal of rigor that goes into the into how cost recovery or integration of the expenses is going to be amortized among rates, and I think that this I'd like to see some greater work on if we're going to go down this road of automatic adjustment of charges as line 1.10, 1.11 in existing statute references, that we do it with a lot greater specificity than the language that's added in section 1. I'm not against doing it. I just think that we have to be very, very careful here that we're not allowing to go again outside that rate case with the broad scope of exciting stuff that Xcel is proposing.
Thank you. Mr. Palmer?
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may, one thing I would like to mention is as we are reacting to the federal stimulus package, there's a number of proposals coming out from the Department of Energy that say we would like an application in a relatively short time, and it requires some kind of matching investment for the state to get it. So different entities are coming to us and saying, we would like Xcel to support our efforts to get these federal stimulus funds for the initiative we would like for our community. And so some of this research, by design, it has to be research, or we can't apply for a DOE research grant, for example, to do it, and this gives us some tools to help accomplish that.
Thank you.
Representative Hilton, if I may also add to the Senate's help, that the language that was offered in the amendment also helps clarify that actually what we'd be doing is filing first a petition with the commission about what is the project that we'd want to do. They would need to approve it and that we'd implement it and do the cost recovery. So there is oversight. It is not like it's an automatic thing. And one of the things that we've found as we've done the battery project in southwestern Minnesota is that just the place for the commission to consider the benefits of that project really wasn't very clear. And we filed it in a cost recovery type filing, and it actually asked us, can we bring that back in another type of more policy filing? And so what the amendment does is actually set up a process for that. So I think we're trying to address those concerns. Certainly happy to keep talking with you about it.
Any further discussion? Seeing none. Thank you, Representative Taylor. House File 1533 will be laid over. Representative Kalin, last bill on the agenda. House File 1605.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 1605 for possible consideration. Mr. Chair and members, part of House File 1605 is an issue in Section 1, an issue that has been of a great interest to me and I hope is of interest to this committee, and that is that currently all utility reporting, I don't think we've ever seen a utility conservation improvement plan report or proposal where conservation and efficiency is anything but the most cost-effective resource available to increase reliability and meet the needs, the growing needs of our utility service territories of our state when it comes to electricity specifically. But that just because conservation is the most cost-effective resource doesn't do enough currently within the financial model of the utilities. And actually, once the especially within Xcel's internal corporate structure, once we move outside of the regulatory scheme and the conservation office to the demand-side management office, when it comes to the chief financial decisions, conservation is usually not the most profitable resource because it can't be capitalized as an asset and thus cannot get a guaranteed rate of return. The issue that Xcel and I have been talking about for as long as I've been in the legislature is finding a means to make that to turn that inside out and make conservation the most cost-effective conservation, the most profitable resource option, as well as the most cost-effective. The language that you see in Section 1 is not yet ready for prime time, I'd suggest, but I think it starts to get to that issue. I think it's important that we try to resolve this issue so that the work that this committee has done over the last two sessions and before actually match up with the most profitable resource options and the financial decisions made within investor-owned utilities. With that, Mr. Chair, I see the A1 amendment has been passed out. It would establish a study rather than enacting a statute. It would ask the Public Utilities Commission to look at and inform us as a state about the total consequences of going down the road that Section 1 and 1605 proposes. Rather than move the amendment, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just have Xcel talk about a process that is currently before the Commission that might help us better understand these issues.
Ms. Foster.
Representative Kelsey, and certainly in response to previous legislation, there are already some types of financial incentive already for conservation improvement programs, but under prior legislation, the Commission has sought comments and actually now is directed a work group that is under the Office of Energy Security is operating, where they are looking at redesigning that incentive mechanism. So that work is underway. We've already filed a couple rounds of comments, and there's some proposals out there, and I think it'll go through a process of narrowing down and coming back before the Commission for consideration. Certainly within any incentive mechanism, there's lots of ways you can design it and lots of sizes it can be. And in the draft bill, it gives some direction to the Commission that would say that incentive should ensure that conservation is the most profitable resource of choice of utilities. And whether that's the language that wants to advance, it's giving some legislative guidance to that process that's underway. Certainly, we're very interested in that process coming to a successful close. I don't want to offer anything that would get in the way of it because that would get in the way of the end objective here, but Again, the point here is what kind of legislative direction might be given to that process, and we're certainly open to working on that. But support overall the concept of really getting these incentive rights so that conservation is our most profitable resource. We think that would be a good thing for our system.
And members, before we go to questions, just to make clear, the A1 amendment is a substantive amendment which was not prepared in time for action today, and Representative Kalin just wanted to put it out for discussion. We will pull that over for possible adoption when we put the omnibus bill together. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had two questions for either the author or somebody from Excel. When we're talking about the language in this bill and we're talking about incentives, just so everyone's clear, who gets the incentives?
Representative Hilty, the incentives would accrue to the company, and the notion being that when we build a plant to serve our customers, we earn a profit on that investment. When we spend money to help our customers not use our product or conserve, we don't. And so at the same time as the customer, you know, while conservation may be the best resource, is the best resource we can put out there, kind of has the double effect on us, one being that we don't earn any kind of return on that investment, and then two being because our sales go down as a result of a successful conservation investment, we actually get less revenue to support the costs we already have. So you've got kind of a double issue going on there that the incentive is designed to help try to address. Our current incentive helps offset that first piece, really, but doesn't necessarily address the second piece. And the question is just how do you bring something together to get to a reasonable package?
Representative Hoppe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that brings me to my second question. You get the incentives. Who pays the incentives?
Representative Hilty, Representative, it would become from our customers. And so the process works that, you know, we first propose all our conservation programs and our budgets to the regulators for approval, and we go out and do those. Once we've performed those programs, we look at how well we delivered them, how much energy was actually saved, et cetera. And there is a formula that calculates an incentive piece for it. Right now, this past year, our incentive was approximately, for both gas and electric, approximately $15 million for both gas and electric on a conservation budget of around $50 million. And so when you think about it, if you had $50 million in investment, what kind of return we'd get, you know, those are the kinds of questions this incentive process should ask it. But once we've gotten the programs approved and we look at our performance, the incentive is calculated and then it's built into a rate adjustment that we charge our customers.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, ultimately the people paying the ratepayers, our constituents, your customers, mm-hmm. if they're, I mean, what's the net effect to be a consumer? Are you saving energy but saving money?
Representative, actually, you know, saving the energy is still going to provide significant benefits on the customer still. Because part of what we avoid will be fuel and other things that we just don't have to buy. If they can serve something that helps them save 10%, that's a significant reduction in their bill. The amount of cost to pay for the program and pay for the incentive is a fraction of that. So certainly a customer that doesn't participate in our programs aren't going to necessarily see those, you know, won't see those benefits necessarily, but overall, it really does still encourage customers. It still pays very much so to have our customers conserve and participate in those programs.
Representative Kalin, did you want to add something to that?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. As you know, Representative Hoppe, the shareholder pressure and the rate of return that our investor-owned utilities can received from the Public Utilities Commission creates a financial incentive to continue to build and own more capital assets. And the difference between the financing, between the loan in essence and the guaranteed rate of return is where the profit is made. If right now we have put a stick on the table with the Conservation Improvement Program, and the incentives we have put on the table compete with the stick inside, but don't then compete with the the financial advantage to go out and build, let's say, a new combined cycle gas generation plant. So there's this loss of financial opportunity for Xcel to pursue, or other investor-owned utilities, to pursue the lowest cost resource, which as you know, fiscally responsible folks, whether it's in government or in the private sector, should be a concern for us, that we, our structure, financial structure we have imposed on the utilities in exchange for adequate and reliable service, actually makes the most cost-effective resource the least attractive option. What we'd like to do is to align those two things.
Representative Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then I'll be done. But to that point, Representative Kalin, I understand what you're saying, and I think it's important for all of us to remember Xcel's not paying this. You know, they just pass it along. It's our ratepayers, and when you use the words that we impose on them, we're not imposing anything on Xcel except more work and red tape and things like that. They're passing the cost on along. And ultimately, it's our ratepayers, our constituents, the consumers, mm-hmm. that are paying more. And I think sometimes we forget that. We're here, we're you know, and the programs we're coming up with are well-intended, and some of them are good and some are not. But ultimately, the ratepayers are the ones that are paying. And, you know, we all need to keep that in mind. There, I'm done lecturing now.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would just like to give some examples so it's clear how this works, and I appreciate the feedback you're giving us. An example would be last summer I was working with Rockton. It's a very public proceeding, and our goal was to save them energy. As you looked at the Rockton bill, 4% of their energy costs went to Xcel. This is one of the most extreme cases, and I'm picking that one, but 4% of the energy bill went to Xcel as far as reimbursement for Xcel costs. The other 96% was the flow through of natural gas, transportation, and purchase costs for supplying Rock 10 natural gas. And so what we're saying is have a structure that gives the utility a benefit. It doesn't have to reduce its earnings because it's out helping the customer save. In the end, if Xcel earnings go up, even if you had a 25% increase in Xcel, that would have been a dime for a significant reduction on the 96% of the total cost. The same thing applies in the electric business, where if we can help save energy, our earnings do go up, but not nearly by as much as the total energy bill to the customer goes down. And so the strategy we've adopted is we can't work with you to necessarily minimize the lowest rate and be able to grow and expand these programs, but we can work with you as a customer to reduce your total energy bill.
Mr. Chair, to that point, and I thank you. I didn't bring it with me, but on Saturday I talked to a number of senior citizens in Chanhassen, and they brought the little inserts that come in their Xcel bills, and I don't have it right in front of me, but the number is 4.8, something like that, percent increase in their utility bills. So the rate they're paying is almost 5% higher, and I might have the number a little bit wrong, but I mean, ultimately what we're doing, whether they're saving money or spending more money, that's what we're getting at. You know, and I know we're saving people money, I know we're conserving, I know we're putting you guys through hoops, but ultimately, you know, the old people that are on a fixed budget are paying 5% more for the electricity that they use in their house.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, this is exactly the kind of conversation I think we need to continue to have. My concern is that currently what's happening is that we're actually making the problem worse by encouraging our utilities to pursue essentially the rate structure that we have mandated in law and the commission to rule, to go after a more expensive way to meet the resource and meet reliability as we've mandated them to, versus the less expensive route. And what we're hoping to do here is to say, pursue the less expensive route. While it does make it more financially beneficial to Xcel compared to within the conservation bubble,
right.
Comparing conservation to new generation, it will actually reduce the impact on ratepayers overall if we can do it right. If we do it wrong, it can make it much, much worse. And that's why I don't want to put this language in the statute.
Representative Hoppe, who is not done after all.
I thought I was, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking out for the little guy. So I can tell my senior citizen constituents that they can look for a rate reduction coming from XL. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe hit on several of the points and themes, but Representative Kalin's exactly right. We need to actually just have an entire session just to vent on these things, because the whole business of conserving our way to prosperity is ludicrous on the face of it. And somehow, you mentioned how complicated these things get as we get into it, and I said, I've got a pretty simple solution to the whole thing, and that is that we just blow up the whole thing and trust citizens and ratepayers to actually make intelligent choices on their own behalf. XL Energy and every other regulated utility can't do anything without proving and begging for a certificate of need and making the case to the PUC that they need transmission generation or rate increase or whatever it is. And I think part of my heartburn with this whole thing is that we're actually disrespecting the ability of our citizens and our ratepayers to choose wisely and to buy better light bulbs or insulate their house or do whatever they can to conserve because it's in their own enlightened best interest. So we just can't stop monkeying with stuff around here, and this is what we end up with. We end up with several bills on an agenda today to try to tweak and fix things as we go along here to help the regulated utility, who just marks it up and passes it on anyhow. Representative Hoppe is exactly right. They don't have a dog in this fight. They're just asking for the ability to pass this on and protect their margins, and I can't blame them. But what do we do with the co-ops or the munis that don't have rate of return regulation? What do we do with those guys where the customers are actually the owners of the company? Has anybody given any thought to those little guys? And don't even get me started on Seabed, a monstrosity we created to try to enable something, some carve-out somewhere. We did that, what, 6 years ago? 5 years ago. And it's been back here every cotton-picking year since, so we can tweak it and fix it, because some unintended consequence we didn't anticipate reared its ugly head. Well, guess what? They will never stop rearing their head. We'll never have any end of agendas that look like this fix things, like CIP, Seabed, and the list goes on and on. So I got a whole pile of stuff we can talk about if you just want to have one bill one time, Mr. Chairman, where we could really air out what's going on here and take a look at some of the history of some of these programs, where it's going. And that doesn't even mention we aren't even looking over the horizon at technologies that are coming down the pike that are completely make all of this stuff that we've talked about today completely a moot point in the proper use of that word. But thank you. I'll hold the rest of my remarks because I know we all need to be at another committee meeting. But I'm grateful that this bill is not going any further in its present state. And when it is ready to go, I'll have a lot more to say about it.
Well, and Representative Beard, I think your points are well taken. And for who knows the umpteenth time, I would reiterate that that is exactly why I thought we needed a Legislative Energy Commission to discuss these things in the kind of context that you are advocating, and hopefully sooner or later we will get to doing that.
Good.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the questions and concerns, Representative Beard, and I will be at as many LEC meetings that I can make sitting in, because I think that conversation needs to happen. I will point out that when we got an overview from Minnesota Power and XL at the beginning of the session, I did ask them whether I thought that they were selling a commodity or a service. And I believe that this conversation gets to the heart of the fact that even stored in through some sort of battery or energy storage technology, we flip a switch and we expect the service to happen. And more and more, I think that the structure that we established in the 30s federally and then in the 70s in the state with our existing statutes, that we have thought of electricity as a commodity or a product when it is really a timely service that means nothing if it's delivered 5 minutes after we need it. And so just to that heart, that I think this gets to the discussion is not the exact language, gets to the heart of the fact that we are in the process of transforming that mindset and that paradigm to a service. And I think the utility that gets to that fastest will actually be the most profitable. I don't think we're there yet, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further discussion, House File 1680 will be laid over. And members, before you leave, you know that on the agenda for Wednesday is Representative Kalen Phil, House File 680. There is an amendment here at the desk that Representative Kalen intends to offer on Wednesday. We will email that to members as well, but if you want a hard copy, members or members of the public, as long as they last, you're welcome to take these, and we will, as I said, distribute this electronically to all of the members. Let me remind you that we are scheduled to have a joint hearing with the Legislative Energy Commission Wednesday evening, 6:30 p.m. in room 200. And also on Thursday at 6:30 in room 200, a meeting of this committee to act on the nuclear moratorium bill. At that time, we will be entertaining testimony from the public. The testimony before the commission on Wednesday will be expert testimony supplied by advocates and opponents for the bill. With that, the meeting is adjourned.